This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcasts at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark here. I'm joined here with Rajiv Ram. He blogs on Substack under Cactus Brahmin. Rajiv, it's great having you on the show.
Yeah, great to be here. I'm glad I was invited.
And I'm also joined here with Francis Nelly Pilater.
Hi, Robert. Hi, Rajiv.
I discovered you via your shows you've done with Walt Bismarck. But to start things off, if you want to just kind of give an introduction to yourself and your political journey.
How detailed do you want me to go?
I guess just sort of a brief introduction.
Okay. Yeah, so like you said, I blog on Substack. My Substack is rajivram.substack.com. I have called it the Cactus Ramen Testimonials. Which you can read my about page for. I do some politicking on there, but a lot of it is personal stuff in terms of sort of my journey. So I'm a second generation Tamilian Indian immigrant. So my parents are from India and they came here to America in the 1980s and had me and my brother in the 90s. So classic late millennial. I was born and raised in Arizona. Went to college in Chicago.
I'm going to Arizona over the 4th of July weekend.
Oh, cool. Yeah, it'll be super hot.
I'm sure it will. I'm going to fly into Phoenix and then take like a short trip to Sedona.
Yeah, oh, Sedona's beautiful. You'll love it. But yeah, so born and raised in Arizona, went to university in Chicago. My life kind of fell apart and I moved back with my parents in Arizona. Then I got a job in the Bay Area, first at a startup, and then worked at Google. And then after COVID, basically a couple of things in my life fell apart. So I took a huge road trip across the country, and now I live in Tennessee. So in terms of my politics, I would say that basically it was inculcated, you know, in the soup of 90s liberalism. Definitely the sense of like civic nationalism, and America is, you know, what they call a propositional nation. So definitely more like kind of like a centrist liberal, or maybe nowadays you'd call it like an old school liberal, you know, the type of person who still has a head on their shoulders and who hasn't descended into crazy extremes on ideology. And then over time, sort of being disappointed by the way that liberalism was kind of liquidating all sort of organic modes of organization and cultural organization. And then basically, especially after Obama and like a lot of the online culture wars in the 2010s, culminating in sort of all of the drama around Donald Trump. And especially after 2020, I had this whole grief process where I was like, okay, so I'm not a liberal anymore because I have no idea what they stand for or what they're trying to do, or if they are trying to do things, they're very objectionable to me. So I hate using the term politically homeless because everybody uses that these days. I would say I still have this sense of like, you know, multicultural pluralism. I really value freedom of association. I value localism. That's one of the reasons I'm sort of living in a small town. I'm sort of experienced that firsthand. And then I guess nominally, I'm like more allied with some aspects of the right wing now, for example, with Walt Bismarck, because they seem to be heading in a direction that directly counters sort of the civil rights regime that we have in America around disparate impact and basically trying to make everyone ultra egalitarian.
How did you discover Walt Bismarck?
Yeah, it's a good question. So a
Oh, by
little
the
bit.
way, I think out of all his bumper music, I got a custom song as well. I think you got the best. I think out of all the songs, I think you got the best intro song.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah, he's a pretty talented music maker. And in fact, we're organizing a music contest soon, where folks can, write their own poetry and set it to music on Suno. So stay tuned for that. But to give a little bit of history before I met Walt in particular, I mean, he was pretty active in the alt-right. And then after Charlottesville, he essentially got completely canceled from public life. So it wasn't allowed on Twitter, it wasn't allowed on YouTube, basically wasn't allowed any platform at all. And he describes that time as kind of like dissociating in his life. And that's when he went, to small town America, and he kind of wanted to do a similar thing that I'm doing. And he's written about that. And so what made him a comeback is when he came on Substack and wrote this piece around why he's no longer a white nationalist or why he's no longer part of the alt-right. And someone we all know through our network, Tracing Wood Grains, actually retweeted that on Twitter, and it became viral. And that kind of launched him into the space of discourse where we are now. And so the way that I met him was I quote tweeted. I mean, there was a lot of people who were making fun of him in that piece, who were being like, "Herder, this white guy thought, that he could go live in a small town, and he failed, and he is stupid because he was a former white nationalist, blah, blah, blah." And I just actually wrote a note defending him, for a lot of one particular aspect of what he said in his piece was that one of the reasons he really enjoyed working in the alt-right was because there was this sense of fraternal camaraderie and openness and creativity and basically comfort with ambition, or at least non-hostility, that, we see in a lot of sort of managerial corporations and even academia. And I basically quote tweeted that, or restacked it, I don't know what you call it, on Substack. And I said, everybody's making fun of this guy, but I completely understand where he's coming from. Like, I am the type of person who has felt like, my ambition and my openness and my creativity has been stifled. I have been hungry for like sort of a fraternal camaraderie in a lot of instances. And I've succeeded and failed in various measures at finding it. And I said a couple other things, and you can put I can send you the actual note that I wrote, and you can post in the show notes if you'd like. And so basically, from there he invited me onto his podcast, and kind of the rest has been developing over time.
Are there examples of issues where you still hold more left-wing views, and are you interested in syncretic politics?
Yeah, so this is a difficult question. So first of all, can you describe syncretic politics? What does that mean?
Fusionism, where you have a unique ideology that combines aspects that could be right-wing and left-wing.
Yeah. I mean, so broadly speaking, yes. I think I get, first of all, really bored, and second of all, really annoyed that based on, at people who basically wholesale adopt their ideology from some platform that's handed to them, mostly because I think it just demonstrates that they actually haven't thought that much about, their
Well, it's
place
a
in the
sign of
world.
their psychological profile, being low in
Yeah.
openness.
Oh, is it directly correlated to that?
I think it is, but unfortunately, I think most people, like, I think mo like, my view is that most people are wired to be conformists, so you'll end up with these political drives where it's these wholesale packages. Unfortunately, that tends to win out.
Yeah, so I'm not like one of the very like uber rationalist, like less wrong types that likes to decouple everything. I think there's some failure modes of that, but certainly syncretic politics makes sense. I'm someone, I guess by circumstance, who's been forced to straddle a lot of different cultural, social, and political lines. And so what that does is if you have a certain amount of intelligence and ambition, you're forced to confront like a lot of different contradictions, and more than that, you're forced to accept that like there are certain contradictions that are inherently a part of life. And so like it doesn't become acceptable to just accept packages like you're saying. So in terms of like more left-wing views, it's kind of, I guess if you describe like the left-right spectrum as oriented towards like right being more oriented towards like natural hierarchies, whether that's like aristocratic or, you know, based on market dynamics or whatever else, and then left is more like egalitarian in terms of like trying to level the playing field either through like political programs or interventions. Is that kind of, would that be an acceptable definition of like?
Yeah, I think it's an acceptable definition, or even, well, like, I guess how your average person would think, like the way they'd probably see it is there's a whole set of views where they might seek, the way your average person would see it, like they think in terms of these like wedge issues like abortion and taxation. But I think that's what you said is a pretty good definition.
Yeah. I mean, so it's interesting.
This is interesting. Even like the alt-right, like there were different sort of layers of the alt-right, but even I noticed a lot of what I found interesting about some of the alt-right figures was that they took views that were not stereotypically associated with the right. Like more, even though they were right-wing in the sense that they believed in hierarchy, but they were more comfortable. They were not traditionally like economically and socially conservative. Especially someone like Richard Spencer.
Yeah, so I mean, personally, especially because, so like, I'm a gay man, but I'm also like, I come from an Indian Brahmin family, and most of them tend to be like very family oriented and in some sense socially conservative in that, you know, prioritizing the family is really important. And yet at the same time, I've never felt like I am like a second class or lesser citizen because of my sexuality. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that.
And where you live is pretty conservative.
Yeah. Right now, it's super, super red county. And what's interesting is, I haven't, I mean, maybe because I don't really come off as, you know, I can pass or whatever. I don't know. Like I've been pretty, it's been pretty easy for me to thrive in a lot of circumstances, even in this small town, even in like the church community that now I'm a part of, that like on the books, they're anti-homosexuality and there's probably a lot of members who hold that view. And yet I've never felt like persecuted or, you know, that I'm not welcome. So, you know, I guess I have a personal orientation, you know, to answer your question about right versus left, which is like, you know, the family unit is probably the best and most stable unit of society. At the same time, like most people are going to sort of have like heteropatriarchal relationships and marriages, but that doesn't necessarily have to be enforced as the only standard for having families. I don't believe, so I believe basically in leaving things to the market for the most part. I'm pretty much a free market capitalist. I do feel like that does have to be accompanied by some sort of maybe underlying metaphysics that can sort of regulate externalities in which the market will automatically descend into like power law dynamics or like race dynamics to the bottom where you're just selling the most short-term like addictive product. But, you know, I think I'm just like very much against all sort of like totalizing universalism, whether it's like free market totalization or like religious totalization. I really like your term enclavism. I guess I come from like a lineage and sort of a civilization that has maintained sort of like pluralistic enclavism for a long time, but has still managed to have a sense of like unity. And I also see that America has done that for a long time. You know, whether or not you want to argue it was because of a specific sociocultural or racial context, like Anglos or Anglo-Protestants, it still managed to do that. And so I guess whoever I consider my enemies, people who feel like their version of totalization is what's going to solve the problems of society, because that just never works.
Do you have thoughts on the HPD implications of the Indian caste system? So did the different castes emerge as an ethnogenesis formed by selecting certain traits personality or psychological traits?
Yeah, so I think the thing, there's a lot of complexities to the caste system, but I think the way I'll like make an entry into this question is that even in the question of like the ink, like what is considered caste, there's actually two different notions that sort of combine to make what you would consider someone's caste. So there's something called Varna, and Varna is kind of like your orientation and your predilection towards certain like proclivities and how you like create value and engage with life. And then there's another part that's called Jati, which is like kind of like your lineage, and like your, broadly speaking, your family, extended tribe group. And so there's a lot of ways in which, so the four Varnas that we usually talk about are Brahmins, who are more the priests and teachers, the Kshatriyas, who are more of the warriors and kings and political administrators, the Vaishyas, who are more of the merchants and the entrepreneurs and landowners, and the Shudras, who are more of just the day laborers and the agriculturalists, and sort of the big mass of people that supports the rest of society. So basically, yes, in some sense, like especially Brahmins sort of became very endogamous in a certain way and selected for like a very high level of intellect, and also just like I don't know how to describe it, metaphysical orientation concerned with like the morality and the ethics of how to get different populations and subpopulations to live together in a unified society.
So basically, like different roles for different archetypes.
Yeah, exactly. And so the thing is, outside of, I mean, Brahmins, because they have such like good record keeping of their genetics and lineage, they tend to have sort of like a stronger caste identity than a lot of the others. And as soon as you go down to like Kshatriyas or lower, like it tends to be a lot more of a mess, and there's a lot less of a collective identity around it. And so then the other aspect of this is, most people think that, Brahmins are these people who are just like ascetics who live in the forest, or, who are only at temples. But you'll find in history, based on displacements of populations, certain groups will end up, Brahmin cultures maybe in the mountains will take up like herding of animals or certain economic incentives. And this is where like the jati kind of changes. So you can imagine like if there's a group of people, let's say, who settled in like the Midwest and they had a certain lineage and they had a certain like skill level, but then they got displaced to like Arizona or the Southwest, right? They would fundamentally have to change their orientation of how they, do commerce and how they engage in metaphysics and how they actually practice out their lives, right? So you can compare, for example, Marathi Brahmins and Tamil Brahmins. And Marathi Brahmins, because the Marathis tend to be more of like warrior type people, the Marathi Brahmins do have some more of like a martial sort of outlook, whereas the Tamilian Brahmins are almost like exclusively ascetic. And then the Brahmins that you see in like North India, closer to Nepal, or even in Bengal, have different practices, right? And so really the only thing that unifies them together is sort of this sense of like endogamy that is selected for high intelligence and maybe like religious and moral orientation over time.
So, like those with a predilection for action might take a different, be in a different direction than, say, like devotion or the intellectual neosis or, say, like meditation. So, you'd say, like, someone who's sort of like high IQ but a bit autistic might be best selected, like, for meditation.
Yeah, there's a lot of funny stories about how basically, in the Hindu pantheon, Shiva is basically the great meditator, the big ascetic, and all he does, like for, thousands of years, is just sit on the Himalaya mountains and meditate on the nature of existence. And so all of the people who follow Shiva, kind of, tend to be those type of people. Whereas if you look at someone like Vishnu, Vishnu is always reincarnating, on Earth, whether it is as a warrior or a statesman, or he has his 10 carnate, sometimes he incarnates as an animal, if you look at the history of things, right? And so he's much more involved in, let's say, the day-to-day affairs of human life. And so because of that, he tends to attract people who are, more oriented towards devotion rather than meditation and asceticism. He has a physical body, he's an incarnation, he takes a human form, and so he expects people to gather around him, as he restores Dharma in this planet, right? And so then you'll have like lesser deities that, like Indra and Agni, who are considered like lesser deities in the pantheon, who a lot of people, Agni is the deity of fire, and Indra is sort of like the king of angels. And so you'll have some more of the warrior people like worshiping those particular deities because, warriors have to have this internal fire and this sort of kingly attitude towards their subordinates. And then you'll have certain sects that worship like the feminine versions of God. So Shaktiism, Shakti being the wife of Shiva. There are certain people who worship the divine feminine, in that regard. And then, there's like kind of cults that worship the sun deity and stuff like that. And so I would say, yeah, there, like Hinduism proper, is designed to sort of like, group certain like collective nervous systems into the ways that they can like find divinity or find communion, if that makes sense, that are most appropriate to them.
I guess it makes sense if it's selected to each person's archetype, but I guess why there's some resentment against caste is someone could be born into a caste that doesn't necessarily reflect their personal archetype, and then maybe there's not enough flexibility. But I guess in principle, like I don't see it as a bad I don't see caste as a bad thing if it were flexible, and because I think American society kind of does lack that pluralism. And it doesn't give people a path that's tailored to their archetype.
But I mean, like this, I'll just use this example, because I have a lot of Mormon friends and I was part of this right-wing Mormon group. Even if you look at Mormonism, right? And it's changed since its inception, but there's a particular type of archetype, or like collective nervous system that does well in Mormonism. And even though all of them like are popping out, well, maybe not these days anymore, but they're popping out like six or seven babies, like four of them maybe stay. And then like three of them find that they can't conform to like what the actual church and the, the syncretic sort of insular politics of the church, and the vocations around that ask them to do that, right? And so they leave and they become atheist or agnostic or whatever else, right? And I'm sure there was a lot of evaporative cooling in that sense in caste. It definitely, there are accusations essentially now that, Brahmins held the reins and subjugated everyone for, hundreds and hundreds of years. And I don't find that to be true. I think if you look at the history of things, it was probably a lot more dynamic and there was a lot more sort of shifting and evaporative cooling between groups.
I'm like working on creating this religion. I don't know if I'd say, I don't even know if I call it a religion, more like a philosophy for understanding like religion and sociology, etc. But that way we combine theosophy with HVD.
Yeah, do you want to say more? That sounds, I mean,
Yeah, so I
interesting.
think about an interesting like. So you take something like the Christian issue of salvation, and if you think about how it sort of selects for a very, if you accept like the, if you take like a Christian view about salvation, only like very specific personality type of person gets saved. So you either have to go in that, be like a Calvinist and believe in predetermination, or you sort of embrace something like theosophy makes a lot more sense. And I guess the irony is that like a lot of theosophists, some of them are more liberal and they see universalism as more of a liberal thing, like all religions. So like all religions, the view that all religions may be like, there's still a hierarchy. Some could be more legit than others, but the idea that all religions are inspired by God, but that religion evolved differently because of how different groups were genetically. Like that's how I kind of came to that. They're tailored, yeah, tailored to different archetypes. So people are not like, Because the problem with a lot of different religions and even specific Christian churches are tailored to a very specific like archetype.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think broadly speaking, I would share that view personally in the sense that, yeah, you can come, like, probably a lot of religions are pointing towards God, so to speak, on different paths. And certainly some are more true or effective. There's a difference between, I think, those who feel like relationship to God is one of, like, let's say law and obedience versus people who think it's one of like mysticism and experience. And so like the ones who are oriented more towards obedience, I think tend to just have this temperament that God shows up as the person who enforces social order in various ways. And I think the ones
That
who
works. I think like that does appeal. Maybe that serves a purpose to the masses, but it like for those who really crave more spiritually, it's not really the answer to them. But even like with Christianity, like you could criticize Abrahamic faiths for lacking that pluralism, but there's still like that diversity within Abrahamic faiths as well.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, if you read some of the Desert Fathers or the Christian mystics, they're definitely more theosophic. God is an experience. It's something you like commune with in terms of like a personal practice, or God reveals to you a personal path or a personal dharma. So yeah, certainly I agree. One thing I will say is that, there's this book, I believe it's called, Taking the One Seat by, I don't remember who it's by, but he's this Buddhist teacher. And in this book, I mean, he's a Buddhist, and he talks about the Buddhist Dharma, but essentially he says that it's nice to kind of, in the abstract, argue about which, religions are more true or more false, but at some point you as an individual sort of like have to take your seat. And that means committing to like what your thing is. And so that could be like, it could be converting to like this more Calvinistic, Salvific, Christianity. It could be like becoming a Buddhist who doesn't believe in, the supernatural. It could be returning to your Hindu roots. It could be, becoming Shinto, right? But at some point, I think there's a way in which if you're not able to commit to sort of like your own path on how to reach God, like, you're not actually going to get anywhere. You're just going to keep flitting around. And so, I don't, to some degree, I do believe that. I mean, there's a point in which, whether or not you consciously choose it, the way you take up a religion and the practice you do, and the way like you let it embody your life in day-to-day life, kind of becomes the way you do it. And like, I just feel like it's better to take ownership over that than continue to, even in like the general way you view the wider world in your personal world, that sort of like taking your seat or taking your path, is probably a good thing.
Do you think the Brahmin versus Vaishya archetypes play out in America and the West? And would you say America is fundamentally a Vaishya nation?
So you're talking about just the archetypes, not the
Not the
literal.
specific castes, but the
Yeah.
archetypes.
Yeah, it's interesting because I definitely think there's been elements of both. Like if you read like about some of the Great Awakenings or like, the abolitionist movement, or you read some of them, like there seems to be like this very like moralistic, zeal that sort of a lot of groups want to enforce on the nation. And certainly it is a weird thing that America, is quite a secular country, but it's also weirdly religious in a way that you don't see other prosperous, economically developed nations being as religious. At the
It's
same
weird
time.
because it's America is more religious and moralistic than, say, Europe, but it's also much more mercantile.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? And so it's. I actually gave a presentation when I was a part of Exit, and I was talking about like Brahmin Vaishya brotherhood, right? Because it does seem like in a way that both of those archetypes have been allowed to succeed in various ways. And certainly, I think right now, I mean, if you look at certain historical periods, like in the Gilded Age, where you had all those, fantastic, barons of wealth, right? And then Teddy Roosevelt came in with all of his like progressive Republican trust busting, right? There was like conflict between Vaishyas and, let's say, Brahmins, right?
So Roosevelt would be someone who was more aristocratic from an older class system, but he sort of limited the merchant class, and that's a common archetype throughout history.
Yeah, exactly, right? I mean, I think there are a lot of people, especially who have that more aristocratic orientation, who do feel a need to sort of give bounds around the market impulse. And so now, definitely, I mean, if you look at the internet age we live in, I think we're completely dominated by mercantile sort of impulses, right? I think that's not really up for debate. And I think one of the reasons there's so much like infighting or factionalism, like on the right or whatever, is like this inability to actually feel like they can culturally constrain the market impulse in this like aristocratic or moral way.
I saw a chart on someone posted on Twitter, and it showed that the wealthiest groups among like billionaires or multimillionaires in India, it's Vaishyas are much wealthier. I think Banyas are the wealthiest caste. It's much more so than Brahmins are.
I mean, I think that makes sense, right? I mean, if you're, and I think that's historically always been the case, the Vaishyas are the ones who are doing the commerce. They were the ones who were selling the spices to the Dutch East India Company, and to China. Brahmins, people, I will say, people tend to have like a conception of Brahmins that they're, again, very poor and they don't, live in the worldly things, but that's not true. There are plenty of sort of a Brahmin jatis, again, jatis being sort of like the different actual lineages. There are plenty of Brahmin jatis that, depending on their context, or if they had like proximity to the water and naval trade, they would have earned more wealth. And there's nothing within sort of like Brahmin teleology or, sort of lifestyle that prevents you from accumulating wealth. It's just they're more concerned with like the social and civilizational structures, and they don't just pursue, wealth above all ends. And so even I think in America, again, like Brahmins are really the only caste in India that have really spent a lot of time tracing their lineage and genetics. Once you get to like even a certain level of Kshatriya, like just the mixing and like the identity becomes a lot more fluid. And so I'm sure like, all the Gujarati Vaishyas who own all the hotels and gas stations are probably richer, than like someone like me who used to work in software engineering,
So
right?
Tamil
And
Brahmins, stereotypically, they mostly go into tech.
yeah. And I've been thinking about that for a while because I mean, some of them go into finance as well, and there's a couple of them that become doctors, right? But it is strange to me how, like, especially even like there are a lot more, for example, Keralite or Telugu doctors than there are necessarily Tamilian doctors, I think. And so it's very interesting to me how like Tamilian Brahmins in particular seem to coalesce around like the technology space, and I haven't mapped it out completely. But like, for example, Satya Nadella, I think he's a Vaishya. I don't know his exact lineage, but he doesn't strike me based on the way he carries himself and how he
What
talks
about the
as.
Google? I think Google CEO is Tamil Brahmin.
Oh yeah, I'm Sundar. Yeah. And the thing is, most of these people come out from like very similar college. So like Sundar went to the same college that my dad went to, IIT Madras, which is basically the top technology school in Tamil Nadu. Right. And so there's a couple of places where if you make it into that school, right, like, and then, you come to America or you emigrate, like, you'll kind of be in the same class and cohort as everybody else who went to that college, even if you're not specifically of the same, like, jati.
Is there a major divide between South and North Indians in the diaspora in the United States?
I mean, major is a matter of relativity, but I mean, yes. I think, how would I describe it? So I think North Indians tend to be a little bit more entrepreneurial. They tend to focus on sort of careers and jobs and social organizations in a way that doesn't prioritize sort of cultural or intellectual influence. And so that would include, people that work either in like owning certain small businesses that are like, the typical, again, example is like Gujaratis that own gas stations, but even like dry
That would
cleaners
be like
or,
Patel's.
yeah, or restaurants or sort of like there's this
I
way
think
in which.
restaurant. I've noticed most of the restaurants, Indian restaurants, are Punjabi and they're run by Sikhs.
Yeah, exactly, right? Or whether it's owning certain like, Indian grocery stores or whatever else, right? I mean, you'll almost never see like a Tamilian or a Telugu like owning like a shop and like doing commerce in that way. Almost all of them sort of gear towards high status employment. And so whether, that's doing an education for a number of years and then becoming a PhD or an academic or rising the ranks on the finance ladder or the tech ladder or something else, right? I think you'll find that South Indians are partly because of their like behavioral predilection to like sort of be willing to put their head down and work at things for a long time within a system
Would you say
until.
a good analogy is South Indians are more, would you say overlaps with like East Asian stereotypes and North Indian more with like Middle Eastern stereotypes?
Yeah, that's a pretty good analogy, actually, I think. Especially because, if you make the comparison to South Indians and East Asians, like East Asians tend to be much more concerned with like how they appear socially and how they integrate with, the rest of society, and there are certain norms around that. Whereas, yeah, I mean, I guess you could say the Arab world is a lot less concerned with, decorum and I don't know how to put it, but that is actually a pretty good analogy. And some of it might have to do with the fact that especially northwest India has a lot more Arabic and Persian influence. And South India, I mean, despite the fact that they're by the ocean, like as a society, they've been relatively insular and endogamous compared to most of the North Indians. And so there's a lot more sense of like cultural and behavioral sort of continuity there that they keep not intentionally exclusive, whereas North Indians are much more blended and mixed, and so there's a lot less, let's say, natural cohesion.
Are South Indians more politically liberal?
I would actually say like South Indians tend to be apolitical in general. But they appear super liberal because that's a survival strategy, right? If you want to climb the ladder, in America, you basically quickly learn how to present, how to speak, how to show up, how to talk about things, how to relate to others, right? And so, I mean, Indians overwhelmingly are democratic, right? They vote for Democrats, but I really don't think that reflects like a sort of like super liberal or progressive orientation, especially not in the first generations. It's just simply a way to comport with the dominant ideology in the country. Because if you look at most Indians, again, they're pretty like, they're not like socially conservative sense in the sense that they're like, Russian Orthodox people who hate deviance, right? But there's a strong focus on family and keeping things like in like sort of your tribe and focusing on the betterment of you and your extended family, right? And that's that generally is not how like white liberals who live in San Francisco or New York tend to operate, right? So I mean my position is that South Indians tend to be like relatively keep their head down apolitical, but they'll vote for liberals because that's what gets them the most acceptance. North Indians actually, there's a lot more variety. They can be anywhere from like viciously democratic to someone like Nikki Haley, who's basically a huge neoconservative, and she's like riding on missiles at
Yeah, so
Israeli people.
Vivek Ramaswamy is South Indian, but I think overall North Indians seem more overrepresented in politics.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. And I think part of that is because most of the ways that Indians have sort of like gotten to politics historically is through like how to describe this? I don't know. Like if you look at someone like Nikki Haley, there's like a very natural reason that she would sort of ally with, you know, the conservative wing, because that tends to be the wing that at least on the face, you know, promotes meritocracy and earning your way around things. But obviously she's not like an Orthodox Christian. And a lot of like the staffers and the people who get hired, you know, they're not going to take sort of like the religious right tack. They're going to have some combination of being like pro-military, pro-free market, and then like pro-family, right? And so the people who can be the most vocal about that are especially people who do come from some of the more martial groups in India, and those who are like less concerned about keeping things insular and like building status in these very sort of enclavey ways.
Is there a big divide between the wave of Indian immigrants who came in the 70s and 80s? I think you said that's your background, and more recent immigrants who were like H-1Bs. I mean, you say the latter is more likely to view America as an economic zone.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, most of the immigrants who came pre-1990,
In 1990, that was the Bush. There was the Hart-Celler Immigration Act of 65, and then there was the Bush Senior enacted another immigration act in 1990.
So a lot of what I would call like the Reagan Indians. So like my parents are examples of people who like loved Reagan, right? These are Indians who are like by nature very pro-American and patriotic. Almost all of them had some sort of elite position at home, and that doesn't mean they were wealthy. Like my parents both grew up not in poverty, but you know, not with a lot of wealth. But they went to good schools, and they were sort of lived in communities, you know, that had high standards of behavior and, you know, some aristocratic training to some degree just in the environment, right? And so these are people who learned English from a very early age, like don't have any resentment towards like colonization, so to speak, or the British Empire, who have a desire to integrate into the Anglo world. And so because of that reason, they genuinely are patriotic Americans, and they want to do their best to integrate, and they raise children like me and my older brother with that sense of civic nationalism. And part of that too is because, you know, they didn't get, I mean, when my parents came here for their PhD program, like their sponsorship was like, I mean, they were paid peanuts, right? My parents were like $5,000 in debt, you know, after their honeymoon that they took to Europe. And so it was really the sense of like, we made it in America and we're going to find our own way. And we're going to do our best to like ingratiate ourselves as citizens. Post 1990s, especially with a lot of manufacturing, mostly going to China, but some of it going to India. And then a lot of like tech support going to, Indian sort of like businesses or call centers. Most of them really don't see like America as a country that they want to integrate into. Part of that is because I think they see like the enormous amount of like degradation of Western culture in the past 10 to 15 years. And a lot of them are kind of asking like, why the fuck would I try to integrate to that? And if they didn't have an experience of the 70s or 80s or 90s where, you know, America was still very, very culturally and economically, you know, fluid in that you could, you know, come from Ohio and still make it, you know, earning six figures at some
I see
point through
that
hard work.
with Latinos and East Asians too, where I think immigrants, because like the dissident right, they use the term like airport Americans and like or Hart-Celler Americans. But I've noticed there is a distinction, like people who were here by the 70s or 80s have some degree of nostalgia for the way things are. But I've noticed, like, I think with immigrants in general, no matter if they're from China or South America or Latin America, like the more those who have came, I'd say like in the 21st century just view America as an economic zone, which I don't really blame them because that's basically how things are now.
Yeah, I mean, that's accurate. And most, a lot of tech companies basically just see a way to hire cheap labor. And that isn't to say there aren't some really good H-1B. I mean, I know a guy actually who's an H-1B guy, and he came here on a tech visa, and then he got, I don't, I guess he got, I don't know, do America have green cards? And he's waiting for citizenship, but he actually quit his tech job. And he's like trying to become a professional cook, and he writes all these poems about like World War II and all of that stuff. I mean, so he's really trying to integrate it in sort of to like the American mythology, but I think that's pretty rare, especially for post 1990 immigrants, and their children. Although I don't know how many of the H-1Bs are actually having children on American soil yet. Unclear to me.
Do you have predictions for the future trends of the profile of Indian immigration? Do you think it will be like more, do you predict it will be like more downscale in future, or do you predict more like a brain drain immigration?
I mean, I think at this point, America has captured all of the high IQ Indians. I think
Right
that's one of the
now, I think
big.
there's actually been a lot of illegal immigrants showing up at the border. That's been a re huge recent trend.
Yeah, including Indians, right?
I think most of a lot of them are Punjabis. They're illegal immigrants.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I don't know the nature specifically of the illegal Indian immigration. Probably you. If you live in California, you're more, tapped into that. And none of them are like coming to Tennessee or whatever. Not yet. I mean, let's see if they make it here at some point. But my feeling is that, I mean, America really did brain drain a lot of like the high IQ, civic minded, Indian elites, in the 70s and 80s. And there's not much left to tap from. So I think two things are going to happen. One is, unless America actually decides to enforce immigration restriction, a lot more low quality, low IQ people are going to immigrate. Indians are going to immigrate to America. And then some of them are going to find that they can't make it here. They can't, they don't have enough skills to compete with all the other immigrant groups that are also trying for the same positions. And so they'll probably try to take some jobs and send some money home, but I think a big portion of them will leave. I can imagine California, like, 10, 15 years from now is just like a bunch of really like low wage, low skill immigrant groups, including Indians who are like just trying to fight it out or with the scraps of menial jobs. And, if they can't make a living, they're kind of going to give up. It also depends on how much, welfare and other, benefits are paid to such immigrants. But, if you really wanted to make them go back, you could just rip sort of the welfare carpet out of all of these folks. And I think they wouldn't have an incentive to stay anymore because they don't really care about America as a country or a project or like a civilization. They just want a higher paycheck.
Do you have thoughts on a lot of the anti-Indian animus on the dissident right? I've noticed this trend where it's sort of become like the new like JQ. Do you take personal offense to it, or you think it's sort of a reaction to like the sheer numbers of immigrants?
Definitely, a reaction. Definitely, especially in Canada. I mean, I think Canada is kind of a lot more fucked than the US in a lot of ways because it has a lot less population and it's been used to having a very low population. And like its immigrant population has just like completely exploded, especially in the last decade. And so a lot of it is just like, yeah, there's too many people, like the housing prices are going
Like
up
there's
too much.
this, I saw this video from Canada of like, of this line that went, it was like this end, there's this video that went viral of this line for applying for a job, and there's like this endless line of like young Indian men.
Yeah. So I think a lot of I think a lot of the animus is around that particularly. I think some of it gets leveled at like the tech workers because a lot of like white people don't really know the difference between different types of Indians and immigrants or pre versus post 90s and stuff like that. I haven't worked in tech for a while. I've heard a lot of people who've told me stories about like, someone will become a manager and then they'll hire a bunch of H-1Bs who all only speak like Hindi or or Tamil or Punjabi and kind of exclude white people and kind of become very, very insular, you know, in that company. That's probably true to some degree, and that's probably something that would make me really
Did you
angry.
notice that when you worked in tech?
I did not. Yeah. So, like, specifically the team that I worked on, first of all, it was 90% male and probably like 40% autistic because it was, you know, the central distributed computing infrastructure, which requires a high level of technical skill. But it was kind of a nice combination between, it was mostly Tamilians who were the Indians. There were some Chinese folks, some Anglos, and a lot of Slavs, right? And Slavs are kind of similar workhorses, right? They're willing to put their head down and do hard labor, you know, and not necessarily have to take the credit for it. But like all of the Indians that I worked with, both in my team and like kind of immediately outward, they again spoke English really well. You know, knew how to behave like Americans. So maybe this is happening in other parts of the company. Maybe this is happening at smaller startups. I'm not sure. I don't doubt that it's happening though, where there's like H-1B Indians who are just very insular and kind of locking white people out of certain positions. Probably happening.
Do you think white people are at a disadvantage for being more individualistic? And do you see them in the future becoming more like whites, becoming more tribal and having like patronage networks? Like I talked about this with Walt Bismarck.
Yeah. I think some of them are trying to, but I really think they would just prefer to have some, like, develop some sort of collective will that could actually enforce, you know, immigration restriction and immigration law. And my understanding is that there's actually, like, no new laws or directives that need to be enforced per se. Like, if there was the political will, like, you could kick out 20 million people tomorrow. It's just the fact that white liberals in general tend not to want to do that for, you know, social reasons. And then, of course, they don't tend to be not the ones, especially if they're wealthy, you have to live with the consequences, you know, because they just get their, you know, house in Bernal Heights that costs $10 million, or, you know, they
and
go
I
to.
Think what's kind of ironic is that I think if immigration continue, mass immigration continues, then you'll see this balkanization to tribalism. But honestly, like the irony is that like a moratorium on immigration would kind of maintain like American civic nationalism longer. But the thing is like, what is America and who is America? It's like kind of hard to define. It's kind of hard to agree upon. Like no one can really define it at this point.
Yeah, are you making the argument that if immigration continues, maybe the whites will actually develop a racial
Yeah, I think
consciousness?
that if immigration continues, I think whites would become more tribal and you'd see a balkanization into enclavism. While immigration moratorium could actually kind of delay like 20th century style civic nationalism, like in maybe another 30 to 50 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that would help for white people to be able to do this would basically gut the entire sort of civil rights regime around like disparate impact and equal opportunity hiring laws and stuff like that. I think in practice, everybody realizes that that's pretty much anti-white, whether or not it's like de jure anti-white, it's de facto anti-white. And I think one of the things, you know, I talk about this with Walt a lot, whether or not, you know, you'll have whites that mix with Latinos and become castizos. You know, he likes to use the word castizo futurism, especially like in Florida, where there's a lot of Venezuelans and Cubans.
But I get where Walt's coming from, but I think like that would, but the question is that would take like a pretty large number of white people for that to work. Like as the white population dwindles, I think you'll see more balkanization. Like what he's talking about, castizo futurism would take like a much bigger demographic disparity.
Yeah. So, sorry, I'm like trying to keep track. There's like five thoughts in my. What was the original question you asked me a couple of minutes ago?
I forget.
Enclavism, right? I think was you might see like white enclaves popping up.
But isn't that kind of, that's kind of like becoming, could you make the case that's kind of like becoming like India? So if America has pan-enclavism or this sort of like multipolar, like pluralism, decentralization with theosophical HPD? Isn't that just sort of like reinventing India?
I mean, I don't think so because, first of all, India has existed. I mean, the country India proper wasn't even considered like one country until British colonization, right? And then after decolonization, there was, all the stuff around Pakistan and like the Muslims seceded, et cetera, right? But for most of history, like India was considered like a civilization. It was considered an Indus Valley civilization. But most of the states were pretty independent. They had like their own kingdoms and sub-kingdoms. And there was kind of just based on language and like heritage, because all Indian languages descend from Sanskrit and borrow from Sanskrit. There was some sense of unity around that, but it was basically one giant, Articles of Confederacy, right? Whereas I think America clearly has never, I mean, it lasted as an Articles of Confederacy for what, like 15 years. And then they were like, oh no, we actually need like a federal government. And then all of the westward expansion after that was like subjected to like, even if there was more like states' rights and freedom of association, it was still underneath the federal umbrella, right? So I don't think you're actually going to recreate India or like this sense of decentralized, like autonomous kingdoms or states, unless you actually, drastically drain power and financial impact from the federal government. Like you'd have to get rid of the Fed, right? You'd have to have like completely like different states. I mean, now they all use the rupee, but even certain villages have certain currencies that they use, right? So like I don't necessarily see that happening unless like the federal government, like you fire 70% of people from the federal bureaucracy and that
Yeah,
maintains.
like there's so many limitations, like to freedom of association.
Yeah, so I mean I'm on the side of, I it's interesting. I've never actually heard the point that, hey, we shouldn't restrict immigration because then whites, will develop a racial consciousness. But I've generally been on the side of like literally close the borders to everyone except like 0.00001% of people for like the next 25 years. And then like, let's try to figure out the fuck who we are as a country anymore. If we even want, I don't know, like maybe people don't want to figure out who we are as a constitutional country anymore. I'm not sure. But I guess that's self-interested because then, I'm not really sure where I belong. Like if I don't belong to like the white enclavism, but like I'm too integrated into the civic nationalism to
Have you
belong.
lived? Oh, you're saying you're too integrated into like civic nationalism, so you've never lived in like a Indian ethnoburb.
No, and it actually disturbs me. Like when I lived in Sunnyvale, and I believe it's gotten a lot worse now, there was a lot of like Indians, and there actually happened to be a lot of Koreans. I don't know what that is. And it actually kind of disturbs me about the lack of white people. Like I like being around white people.
I guess that's like where. Well, Pillater, you want to talk about like what you're advocating for, because that kind of fits in
I'm actually in
with.
Japantown in San Francisco. So, I mean, I've been from the South, San Francisco on Grand Avenue, and then I was in Daly City, but now we're in Cathedral Hill, Japantown. And I'm not really was I know Sunnyvale, San Jose area is for the people that just don't want to spend that much money downtown, so they go there as a way. But then in return, you kind of have a congregation of that. And so I think there is a benefit of being in Daly City because it's all Filipino. There's a benefit of being in Japantown because it's the last of Japanese Americans and mostly Korean Americans. And there's a benefit, of course, being in, South San Francisco because it's all Mexican. And so I could see, understand that if all the Indians are in Sunnyvale, then it kind of gets a little boring and out of touch because then you realize that there's no communities. It's just kind of segregation, rather, and then people just commuting in and out on that same road back and forth from Brisbane.
Yeah, I mean, I just the other thing too is that, and I don't know how other second generation Indian immigrants feel, but all of us feel a lot more American than we feel Indian. And so, we have our like parents and grandparents, who like, when we go to like temple or we do certain rituals at the house, we pay respects to them and pray to them and stuff like that. But I really don't think any of us who are second generation and who went to like Protestant public school and all of this other stuff are really looking to like actually be enclavists. So we're kind of in a precarious position.
We're getting close to the end of the show. Is there anything else you'd like to add, or Rajiv, do you want to plug any upcoming projects?
Well, go check out my Substack and subscribe to it. That's not necessarily a political Substack. It's more a lot of things that I'm interested in. A lot of the political energy right now is, kind of being dedicated towards this Walt-Right project.
Or you have a podcast that you do regularly with him and a few other people.
Yeah, it's called the Overton Window.
Right.
It's
So
a good one.
and then your Substack, it's more philosophy, psychology, and culture.
Yeah, that's an apt description. I feel like it's reductive, but I'll take it. it is literally just me trying to discover who I am and how I'm supposed to fit into a lot of different identities and cultures that I'm trying to grapple with. That's when it was started, and also a big strain of it has been like, okay, well, the civic nationalistic liberalism that I grew up with and spent a lot of loyalty to and de-raced it in myself for has kind of collapsed. And I don't think anybody really wants to go back to that very strongly. So what the fuck do I do now?
Yeah, I think like what you were touching upon is if there's a shift to enclavism, I think it would mean it would, I think it, I actually do think it would be difficult for people who are like second or third generation immigrant backgrounds who really sort of assimilated into the civic nationalist identity of the late 20th century. Like it would be easier, I think it would be easier for white people, and it'd be easier for new immigrants who have arrived in the 21st century. But I think for people who were from an immigrant background but assimilated into the late 20th century, I think, but I guess maybe they'll form their own form of enclavism. Like Francis, what you're advocating for is like an identity politics for combining whites and Asians, basically.
And that's
If you
just one of the stories.
if you want to kind of introduce that, it's been discussed. We've just talked about it before in the podcast, but if you want to kind of explain that briefly.
I mean, I can go by the names of Eurasian futurism or the technology of anime realism or a subculture of AXA. The point of being is that as no one can define white anymore, as liberals like to say, it's a social construction or it's middle class values, then everybody must be cosmopolitan. But the problem is identity is natural. And so instead of having cosmopolitanism where everybody's still blank and liberalism is the credo, you can't have that. So everybody's just going to default to second best in line, Asian. And so everybody, if they're going to default to an identity, they will say Asian over white because to the normal person, that's just a social construction. But Asian, you could pick, Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Southeast, it's there
So,
and you
Litter,
could
do
be
you
half.
consider is Asian Aryanism whites and East Asians, or would you consider South Asians part of that too?
I would consider South Asians and as well Indians because the reason why it goes back to that Indo-Aryan ideal. And it just means that the BRICS world or that part of the world becomes engulfed into everything over G7. So I think it's more than that. I think it's about identity and about this Emile Durkheim ideal
For
of an
trying
erasure.
to, because liberalism, like, it atomizes and deracinates people. So it's like, instead of becoming a reactionary, you take from subcultures that are associated with liberalism and you try to create something that's more rooted and more authentic from that.
It's interesting because a big assumption of this, which is actually an assumption that my co-host Sunshine, who's a half white, half Korean, so he's your typical Eurasian futurist. He's basically said the reason for this is because white is not aspirational, right? And there's an argument about whether that's like inherent to the way that white people are inherently like individualistic and universalistic. But I kind of feel like if you got rid of a lot of this civil rights nonsense, white would probably become aspirational again. Like, I think one of the reasons is that the incentive landscape has steeply steered against whites. And if you remove sort of that boot on top of the neck of whiteness, it might return. I don't know how much it would return, but I mean, to your point about why people don't want to find their identity in whiteness and then take their secondary identity.
I think if they do find identity in white, it's probably going to be the subculture of voting Trump, living in Pennsylvania and liking particular country music. And that will be, like Robert says, aesthetics based and clearly subjective. And the problem is it can't be a majority vote because it's too niche. It's like Christian Lander says, the right kind of white people and the wrong kind of white people. The wrong white people like NASCAR and Vin Diesel movies and the right kind like electronic music and Brooklyn. So that's going to be a problem.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that because there's a way in which, like, I think I've permanently coded myself as, like, anti-liberal because I do MMA and I own a Glock now. And, like, I don't watch UFC or anything like that, but the cultural associations that I've adopted since moving to the South have kind of, like, excluded me from, the electronic music Brooklyn type of archetype. It's funny.
I think it's just going to be a very rhizomic clash. And I think, as going back on Robert Stark's position, one, it could be enclavism. I would say it's not libertarianism to its end. I think you're still going to have a majority, but this majority of normieism is going to be Asian, even though it's not going to question it. In other words, we might be continuing the word white, but there'll be an overtone window within white, and what it means to be white might as well be half Asian, and
Interesting.
because in art, because of its artistic choices, its intellectualism, its politeness, because it overcomes the decadent dead end of hedonistic and hedonism and liberalism. But they'll see some assimilation between the two, though, I think, and that's where you explain the punk culture aspect.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it's interesting that you include Indians as a part of that. I've never heard a formulation. I mean, people, when they say that stuff, tend to pretty starkly contrast between East Asians and South Asians, and so it's interesting how you include that, and I can see that happening. I mean, I personally know both a lot of Indian women and Indian men who have married white people, and so part of that's gonna, I don't know,
They're gonna
Dravidian.
have to come to terms with a Freudian background of psychoanalysis, the decision, the ultimate decision of why and what is a sexuality and what is a desire. And I think that has more superiority over Jungian archetypes. And I think that's driving the far right crazy because they don't want to talk about Freud because he's Jewish. But I just think that's a fallacy of its own, probably came from Heidegger or something, but that's where it's going.
That you just opened up a whole new topic. That's kind of funny.
We could
That
almost
you,
do a whole nother show on that.
yeah, I was like, that kind of came out of left field at the end there. It seems like there's a lot to dig into. So,
I would think ultimately, I think Jacques Lacan seems to be the Western understanding of Freud and going from there and this direction, wherever you see if it's Zizek or not, or René Girard, there's different aspects of psychoanalysis. But long story short, it doesn't have to be Jewish, because that's just a big digression and mistake. It's whether you understand psychoanalysis, the
well, it's
subconscious.
how I think how people are not honest with themselves about, like, I would actually say, like, with wokeness and the whole idea of implicit bias, even though, like, the premise is anti-white, I think it's actually correct in the sense that people don't do all these things subconsciously that motivates their politics and their social decisions, and they're totally not aware of that. Like,
I think that's what frustrates me. I mean, we started this conversation about like syncretism and being open, right? And I think one thing that happens when you actually confront a lot of these unconscious drives is that you want to bring them out more into the open, which then you're forced to like adopt non-packaged beliefs, which requires a certain amount of openness, right? And it drives me up the wall, the number of people who are unwilling to do that.
Yeah, I mean that's sort of like the very essence of my political project, but there's almost a sort of Gnostic angle to it as well.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you're more theosophic, I can see that.
I think people are just going to come to terms with what they like, and it's going to be beyond preferences and more into desire. It won't be just a subjective libertarian choice because being anti-liberal
Yeah.
means overcoming that. So then you're just born into it. You're going to be an Indian woman saying, I like white men. That's an identity politic. That's a subculture. That's an artistic choice. That's me.
Hey, I mean, if it brings out more honesty in it, you know, it prevents people from hiding under these weird ideologies that are run by like shadow things that they never want to bring to the surface, I'm all for that.
We're at the end of the show. Rajiv Ram, great show. Thank you so much for being on. And also thanks, Francis Nelly.
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate it.
Thank you.